Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Ann Woolfolk. I'm here on behalf of the medical examiner today. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of rebuttal time. Today, the medical examiner is seeking a reversal of the decision by the Superior Court. The Superior Court denied the motion to compel filed by the medical examiner. The items sought, items 1 and item 2 on a privilege log, were submitted by Psychiatric Hospital, Dover Behavioral Health System. I'll call that the hospital. Items 1 and 2 were created by the hospital in connection with the choking death of Joseph Heverin in February of 2008. Item 1 is a self-investigation that was conducted by the hospital at the direction of the licensing agency, the Office of Health Facilities Licensing and Certification. I'll call that the licensing agency. Item 2 is a factual incident report that was prepared by a mental health technician who is employed by the hospital. It contains, according to the privilege logs, the circumstances surrounding the incident. I'd like to just provide a structure to the court of my argument today. First, I'll present my argument in chief, that is, that the Superior Court erred as a matter of law when it ruled that items 1 and items 2 are privileged against production in response to the ME's subpoena. As part of that plain meaning argument, I would like to address the waiver issue as to item 1 and why the concerns of the Superior Court relating to waiver were misplaced and incorrect as a matter of law.
Can you give me some background on the subpoena power of the medical examiner? Is it just for documents, or could the medical examiner subpoena the author of the factual incident and say, tell us what happened?
The subpoena power of the medical examiner is contained in 29 Del Code Section 4709, and that power is broad. That power requires that the ME examine all of the circumstances of death. It authorizes the medical examiner to administer oaths, take affidavits, subpoena and interview any of the staff of the hospital.
So the medical examiner could have someone report, swear him in, and say, now, do you tell me what you saw?
Yes.
Did that happen here?
That did not happen here. What the ME was seeking then and continues to seek is the contemporaneous statement, factual statements by the staff who were eyewitness to the events at issue, and believes that it's entitled to that under its subpoena power.
So that you say contemporaneous, these reports were done the same day as opposed to at the part of the peer review process?
Yes, they were done virtually simultaneously. If not that day, then the next day.
But the latter part of Justice Ridgely's question was as a part of the peer review process. They were done that day or near that day, but was it independent of a peer review process, or was it done in anticipation of or in preparation for a peer review process?
Well, that depends on which item the court is asking about. Item 1 was prepared because it's required to be prepared by another state agency. The licensing agency has the authority to require that and did require it as a self-investigation. That was not prepared as part of the peer review process, according to the face of the log. The other document was, according to the face of the log, was prepared as an information-gathering tool for use by the peer review committee.
But item 1 was used by the peer review committee as part of its process, was it not?
According to the privilege log, it was, but it was not prepared for the exclusive use by the peer review committee. It was actually prepared for the licensing agency as required by federal law.
Isn't the licensing agency also a peer review committee?
The licensing agency has the authority to sanction the hospital. It's not part of the peer review process of the hospital. It does not engage in candid and frank discussions about the quality of hospital care. It comes in surveys, it looks for deficiencies, and if it finds them, imposes penalties. While it may be that in and of itself, for its own purposes, the licensing agency reviews medical care. It is certainly not part of the peer review committee of the hospital.
But independently, is it another peer review organization?
No, it's not. It sanctions hospitals. It doesn't do peer review work with hospitals.
But does it work to improve the quality of medical care?
It does work to improve the quality of medical care, like presumably any governmental agency that oversees medical care does. The ME reviews medical care. And under that argument, if the definition peer review agency is that broad, it would include the medical examiner as well.
Well, perhaps, this issue could get clarified if you could tell us what, in your view, the peer review process is. Because different people may be using the same term to mean different things.
Well, a peer review committee is a group of people brought together, experts and those knowledgeable with medical care, whose job it is to review what happened in a given incident, offer criticism, offer suggestions, and offer means to improve the process so it doesn't happen again. That's not what the medical examiner
does. The peer review process as you envision it is triggered by a specific case.
That's correct.
And that case is discussed, but with a view toward improving procedures for cases that haven't happened yet.
As well as review the one that did occur.
That did occur.
Yes.
All right.
What I'd like to do is, after I present my argument in chief, I would like to address the exclusive use issue as it applies to item 2. And you recall item 2 is the report that was created for the peer review committee according to the face of the law. And nonetheless, the ME believes that it's entitled to that as well.
I have another question about the medical examiner's office. Let's assume that the items are produced as you want them produced, and then a civil litigant notices a deposition for the medical examiner. Dukas Tecum, all the items that you got from peer review. What privilege, if any, applies there?
I think that's that's exactly the question I wanted to reach, Your Honor, and thank you for asking. If it's the ME's position that, on the plain meaning of the statute, these items are not privileged in the face of its subpoena. Therefore, those items go to the ME. Now a lawsuit gets filed. The ME, as you've suggested, gets a Rule 45 subpoena. And it's the ME's position that then, now in the course of civil litigation, now the hospital has the opportunity to raise the privilege issue, simply because now it is being sought in connection with a court subpoena or discovery. The issue, the appropriate time would be to raise it then.
And your position would be it would be the hospital presumed defendant in that civil litigation who would move to quash the subpoena?
I assume they would move to quash or move for a protective order.
Well, what about the medical examiner's office? Would they assert that they've got this material which otherwise would be privileged but was not privileged for them, and then they would refuse to turn it over until there was a motion to compel?
Certainly any subpoena that they would receive would be accompanied by a notice of deposition that would go to the hospital. So the hospital would have notice assert the a privilege then, and the privilege isn't waived if the materials were produced without notice, and that's Delaware Rule of Evidence 511.
What if the Attorney General's office wanted the material for some purpose?
The Attorney General's office would certainly be entitled to review the records of the medical examiner. If they sought that information, yes, they would get it. But once more, in the context of a criminal case, should that come up, then once more, parties, witnesses have a right to an in-camera inspection under the criminal rules of the Superior Court, specifically Rule 16 and Rule 26.2. So they, too, would have an opportunity to raise the privilege and seek an in-camera review in the Superior Court.
So well, how could they assert a privilege that doesn't apply to them?
The privilege is for witnesses and for parties under the criminal rules. It's for criminal defendants.
Well, there's nothing, at least in the briefs, that have been presented that obligate the medical examiner to make any arguments to preserve the privilege, in this case, of the hospital. Correct?
I don't know that the ME would have an obligation to maintain the privilege. I would suggest that under the prior decisions of this court, under the Lawson decision, the ME must keep protected health information private. That was the holding of Lawson, as it's contained in Lawson in autopsy reports and death certificates.
Let me see if I have this right. What we seem to have is a springing privilege. That is, the documents 1 and 2, as far as the medical examiner is concerned, are not privileged, correct?
They are not privileged as to the medical examiner,
all right,
yes.
But once a third party, that is, some stranger, wants access to those documents and subpoenas them from the medical examiner, then the privilege springs into being, correct?
I would say that the privilege is preserved. It is not waived when the records go from the hospital to the medical examiner.
Okay.
It's preserved and therefore can be asserted in the course of private civil litigation.
And why is there no waiver when the documents go to the medical examiner?
Because under the plain meaning of the statute, the documents are not being sought as public records or in connection with a court subpoena, or in connection with discovery.
Yep.
Therefore, the privilege just doesn't apply there.
Yet your side appears to argue that when those same documents are are delivered to the licensing agency, which also has a statutory right to them, there is a waiver.
It's an alternative argument, Your Honor. Either they are waived when they are produced to the licensing agency.
Well, either they're waived or they're not. Why are they not waived as to your agency if they are waived as to the licensing agency?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, your position seems to be that even though the hospital is required to deliver those documents to the licensing agency, that's a waiver.
And
there is no waiver when your agency is involved. How come?
There are alternative arguments. In the our first argument is that the privilege is waived upon submission outside of the peer review agency if as the Superior Court below ruled that it's not waived, then based on the plain meaning of the statute, it's not a waiver when they're given to the ME either.
When you describe the subpoena power of the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in response to Justice Ridley's question, it sounded very much to me like an Attorney General's subpoena. So if we were to rule in your favor on your first argument, not your alternative argument, would we not open the statute up to make this material subject to an Attorney General subpoena when the Attorney General is perhaps investigating the possibility of bringing a homicide charge against a similarly situated decedent in a healthcare environment?
Well, of course, that isn't the question before the court today, but I would submit that, yes, the powers are very similar.
Well, yeah, I know that's not the question before us today, but for better or worse, we need to take a broader view of the implications of every decision we make. Unlike Congress, we have to be concerned about unintended consequences of our actions. So if we were to agree that the Office of Medical Examiner could reach this material because either there was no privilege as to them or it was waived, would we not put the Attorney General's office in the same shoes when a fact situation very similar to this may come up in the future.
I think that that is an accurate statement, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
Now, the medical examiner is part of the Attorney General's office. Can the Attorney General tell the medical examiner to subpoena someone or documents?
Well, the medical examiner is not part of the Attorney General's office. It's actually part of the Department of Health and Social Services. The medical examiner would typically expect that the Attorney General would seek third-party records like these directly from the source. So I don't think that the medical examiner would anticipate that the Attorney General would ask that that the ME issue a subpoena. I think the medical examiner would expect the Attorney General to issue its own subpoena. And, Your Honor, I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, and I'd like to just take an opportunity to sum up. There are really two important policies at play here, but both can be accommodated. This court can grant the ME access to all information that might be privileged in the course of civil litigation and nonetheless preserve the right of the hospital to assert the privilege in civil litigation to further the free exchange of ideas. And if the court rules that the plain meaning of the statute grants the ME access with the knowledge that the privilege can be asserted later, then the court accommodates both of those important interests. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Ridgely, Justice Jacobs. May please support Norman Brooks on behalf of Dover Behavioral Health System. I'll take just a few seconds to introduce my client. Certain members of the panel may know the hospital better by its previous name, the St. Jones Center for Behavioral Health, located over on Horse Pond Road, just off of South Little Creek Road. The facility was acquired by UHS in January of 2007, and it is a acute care psychiatric hospital where the average stay for a patient is just under 1 week. I'd like to pick up on the statement of my friend a few minutes ago concerning the timing of these particular reports. The document identified as item one in the privilege log is titled A Report on Investigation of Patient Death. As we indicated in the privilege log, this document was actually completed on March 17, 2008. The date of death was February 25, 2008. So a little more than three weeks had elapsed while this particular report was being generated. This is not a contemporaneous statement by a witness. The author of this particular report, it was co-authored by, there was one author for this document according to the privilege log, and that was Joanne Marson, who was the director of risk management and a member of the peer review committee.
Could the medical examiner, just so I understand the parameters of your argument, could the medical examiner subpoena, either before or after that report was written, the author and put him under oath and say, tell me what you saw?
They could, Your Honor. They certainly have the authority to take the statement of the witness and say, tell me what you saw. This particular author did not see much at all. She is the risk manager. She is prepared this report based upon input that she's received throughout the process.
All right. Well, tell me what you know. They could ask, they could inquire as to that, so that your assertion of the privilege, as I understand it then, is this correct, is for the document because it was sent to the peer review committee as opposed to the information that could be obtained from other sources?
No, I believe the medical examiner would face the same hurdle if they issued a request or they issued an oath and took the verbal statement of any of these witnesses, that if they started to delve into discussions that were had during the peer review process, that there would be an objection. At that point, try to reach an agreement concerning the scope of the questioning and to limit it in such a way that it could address the facts as concerning what this particular witness saw, heard, felt, tasted, smelled, did during the incident itself without going into discussions in the process itself. The second document is actually titled A Healthcare Peer Review Report. This is not my title. This is the title that, in preparing the privilege law, we took right off of the document itself. I think it illustrative in looking at the appellant's opening brief, where they formed the issue in such a way that they refer to this document as an incident report. And then we give our position in the answering brief, and in the reply brief, this same document is referred to as a witness statement. Now,
when was it prepared in relation to the incident?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It was prepared the day of the incident, February 25. It is a rather perfunctory document. It's a one-page report. We have summarized it in. I'm sorry. It's a two-page report. We have summarized it in the privilege log. The information on the privilege log probably is about as long as the actual report itself. It's just saying what it is as opposed to describing it, as opposed to saying the substance of it.
I assume that your health institution's records kept in the ordinary course of business about the facts surrounding a particular incident would be records that would be available to the Office of the Medical Examiner.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so they would know who had been a witness to the incident or who was involved in the incident or who was perhaps even nearby. Is that correct?
Oh, they do know that, Your Honor. We did provide them with a copy of the incident report that we sent to the Division of Long-Term Care and Residence Protection. And that is an incident report that it essentially gives a synopsis, a brief description, including the witness information, and it goes into the fact that this gentleman was a patient. He was eating lunch. He started choking. They tried to clear the airway. The blockage was not able to be removed. Paramedics were called, and he was transported to.
What I'm trying to get at is, in response to an earlier question that, again, Justice Ridgely asked, if the Office of the Medical Examiner knew who was present from whatever source document at your health institution, they would be able to subpoena that person into their office. They would be able to take a statement from that person and gather facts that may or may not be complete, but at least to be some information about
absolutely,
that would be helpful to their investigation.
Absolutely, and we have given that information on the last page of the privilege log, identified as item number 8, is a group of statements authored by DBHS employees during the period February 25 through February 27, so the day of the incident and the two following days. And we've identified there six RNs, two mental health technicians, and one, the chief operating officer, all as persons who have knowledge of this and have given statements other privileges were raised, and those documents are not sought. So they have three statements that we actually produced. They have the identity of all of these folks, and there's no question that the ME is authorized to call these folks in, take their statements, and go over whatever facts they deem of interest to them. The question is not whether they're authorized to investigate, but whether the ME is authorized to our investigation. And that is, when I say our investigation, I mean the peer review protected investigation that was done by the internal peer review committee and the peer review process to the extent it was done by outside peer review organization. I believe the point wasn't argued well at the trial court, but it's very clear that when we produce this document, that is document item number one, that's on a form that's required by the Division of Health and Social Services. This particular form, it goes to the very heart of the matter. I mean, candor is encouraged in this. By producing this document to the licensing, we have not only a requirement to do that, but we have an incentive that by showing our efforts to completely ventilate the issue and to get to the bottom of it, to what's called the root cause analysis of it, we're making a good faith effort to ensure that this similar incident is not repeated. This particular report, it contains a description of the incident, a synopsis of the witness interviews. It reviews the patient's medical records, the director's findings, and the director's recommendations. Certainly, much of this information, probably all of it except for the director's findings and the director's recommendations, are available to through interview of these witnesses and by means that are not protected by the process itself. I would note that when we identify a review of the patient's medical records, this particular patient had been in the facility about 6 months. The stack of medical records was about 18 inches. This analysis was not done with a view towards just reading everything and regurgitating what the treatment was and what the complaints were and going through the SOAP format each day.
Can I explore for a minute your line of thought on information available through other sources? Do you suggest that the medical examiner could subpoena the licensing agency to produce item number one? Or is the document privileged even in their hands?
It should remain privileged even in their hands, Your Honor. That's our concern is that this is what has happened in the past, is that these documents are being produced to certain peer review organizations, and then they are responding to subpoenas which are very similar to the subpoena which we receive, which is all records, and they're produced because they're under the signature of the Attorney General's office.
So is it your position that the document is privileged, item number one, when it's produced to the licensing agency?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and it remains privileged there because that group, that organization is a peer review organization, no different than the organization that was created under the DHSS to determine the procedures, policies for grounds privileges for patients at the Delaware State Hospital. You know, that particular organization, a unit under DHSS, is not particularly authorized by statute or identified by statute as being a peer review organization, but the court held that since it does review records, review physicians' care, review policies and procedures with a view towards improving patient care, then it is within the meaning of the peer review statute a peer review organization.
Well, Mr. Brooks, I think that's part of what is engendering the confusion here. Normally, when we speak of peer review, we're talking about peer review by the organization in which the patient was housed and in which the doctors were practicing. Your view of peer review organization expands the scope of that to other institutions that have nothing to do with either. Is that a fair use of the term?
I don't think it is fair, Your Honor. The statute itself does use the term organizations. I understand that most of the case law talks about peer review committees and deals with internal peer review committees, very similar to the one that was done internally here by Dover Behavioral. But the actual statute under 1768A says that members of other peer review committees or organizations whose function is the very review of medical records, Medicare, and physicians' work with a view to the quality of care and utilization of hospital facilities. That was the very issue that was presented to the court in Hagedorn v. Davidson, a 1990 decision by President Judge Stiftel, where there was essentially a committee, a grounds committee, and their purpose was to review.
Before you get into that, Mr. Brooks, opposing counsel argues that under your definition of a peer review agency, the ME would be a peer review agency as well. My question to you is, suppose we find that the licensing agency is not a peer review agency. Does that matter to your position? That is it essential to your position that we agree that the licensing agency was a peer review agency?
Well, I think it does matter, Your Honor. I don't see any reason why it would be any different than the Division of Long-Term Care and Residence Protection that was cited by Judge Young in his opinion, footnote 22 on page 9 of Judge Young's opinion. He specifically states that this disclosure to the Office of Health Facilities Licensing and Certification was mandatory. By statute, this office is part of the peer review process.
Yes, but those are two separate statements. It may be, as Judge Young held, that the production of those documents, or document number one, to the licensing agency was mandated by statute. If that's the case, is it critical to your position that we also agree that the licensing agency was part of the peer review process? Was a peer review agency?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe both are peer review organizations within the meaning of the
if we disagree with that, then you lose, right?
Then I think we all lose, Your Honor, because I think what would happen if any hospital knew that this sensitive document where they expose their innermost vulnerabilities to these organizations, I think would have a chilling effect on the candor in those reports, and there would be more window dressing, maybe longer reports, saying nothing, and not really getting to the root cause of the issue. Judge Young, I think, was very aware of that issue, and he identified that as part of his rationale for holding that it was a peer review organization within the meaning of the statute.
But isn't it fair to say that's only important to your position on the waiver issue? It's not important to your position on whether or not the Office of Chief Medical Examiner can get what they attempted to subpoena directly from the institution where the incident occurred. You're still protected by the statute from that direct request, correct?
One would think, Your Honor, but it's our understanding that these subpoenas are issuing and these documents are being produced in response to the subpoena.
Well, has that happened in this matter?
I have to answer out of both sides of my mouth, unfortunately, Your Honor. We have had a letter that was written submitting a similar report in the Christine Auer fatality, which was months after that, where there was a request for it to be made part of the record and considered in this case, because that report is similar in form and as a practical matter, it is identical in form to the report here.
That's a separate case. What I'm asking is, was the licensing agency subpoenaed in for the incident, which is the subject of this case?
For this particular Hebron report, Your Honor,
right.
I do not believe that the medical examiner has acquired this report through subpoena powers, subpoenas issued to any of the HSS sub-organizations.
Is there, you're chilling the candor of the get to the root cause of the problem argument, if I can summarize it in three disconnected phrases. Does that argument extend to preparation of materials that are submitted to the committee, or is it an argument that really should be focused solely on what the committee does with what factual statements they've received, how they deliberate, what conclusions they reach, and what changes they recommend?
I think it should apply to both, Your Honor. And again, this is an evolving process for our particular hospital. I mean, we're learning every day about how to best work these issues and maintain some level of confidence. Certainly, you could have a risk manager take a statement and essentially say, tell me everything you saw. Tell me everything you did. Tell me everything that this person did. Go take the tablet, sit down, and write your statement. However, the more astute risk manager now will just say the facts and ask for the facts of what they did in the response or without asking the question in such a way that it volunteers a statement like, it was the worst thing I ever saw. I never thought he was make it. There's a way to get to the facts in such a way that they're not inflammatory.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I just have a few comments to make in rebuttal. First, as to item one. Again, we're talking now the report that was done for the licensing agency. This court never needs to reach the waiver issue. I mean, that report was not created for the exclusive use of the peer review committee. The face of the privilege log tells us that. It was created for the licensing agency, and therefore under the most expansive reading of the privilege, it was not, it simply is not privileged because it was not created for the exclusive use of the peer review committee.
Well, isn't it still a record of the peer review committee?
It is, I don't believe it is a record of the peer review committee. It was created for the peer review committee. Now, the court, Judge Biferato and Connolly B. Lavalitz had the broadest interpretation when he said any document created for the exclusive use of the peer review committee. If the court declines the ME's invitation to give a narrowing construction to that, then even under that interpretation, it was not created for the exclusive use of the peer review committee. It was created for the licensing agency.
Just one question. The exclusive use rule that you're arguing for, is that found in the language of the statute, or is that simply a gloss?
It is not in the language of the statute. In fact, it was used for the first time in Connolly versus Lavalitz, where the issue before the court wasn't even whether a document was or was not privileged. That case dealt extensively with waiver, but there was the statement at the beginning that any document created for the exclusive use of the committee is protected. The statute itself says the records of the peer review committee.
Well, why wouldn't it, in the typical meaning of record of anyone, is whatever's in the file?
There is a distinction, I think, that needs to be drawn there between, in furtherance of the policy behind the peer review committee, between the information gathering or investigative phase versus the exchange of ideas, candor, frankness, the proceedings of the committee itself, not the creation of documents, factual documents, to be used by the committee.
So there would have to be, if this was litigated, a in-camera inspection with the judge looking to see what was produced just to the committee as opposed to what is produced by the committee?
It would, if in the course of private civil litigation, yes. Again, our position is it doesn't apply to the ME at all, given the ME's subpoena power, and that it wasn't in connection with a court subpoena or discovery. But yes, in a private litigation case, yes, and the courts do that routinely. And I see I'm out of time.
Another question. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the court case under advisement and recess.